My name is Jim Eisner, and I am Director of Media Relations at Harvard Business School. This is the first in a series of video podcasts we're going to do for the school's Working Knowledge website. With me today is Richard Tedlow, a noted business historian on the HBS faculty, and the MBA class of 1949 professor of business administration. His latest book is a biography of Andy Grove, a founding father of Intel, which has gone from startup status in 1968 to a ranking of number 49 on the latest Fortune 500 listing. Anyone with a computer is familiar with the phrase Intel Inside. With this book, Professor Tedlow has taken us inside Andy Grove. Richard, it's great to have you with us today. You've written about giants of enterprise in several of your previous books, the Watsons of IBM, Sam Walton, for example. What led you to focus this time on Andy Grove?
Having looked at CEOs, as you mentioned, in other books, and really having studied the phenomenon of the chief executive officer all my professional life, I just think that Andy's the most interesting one there is. And so the chance to write about him was an opportunity I didn't want to give up.
HBS is famous for field-based research, where faculty members go out into the field and observe a company or workers or whatever. This book involved a lot of travel for you, or time spent in Silicon Valley. Tell us a little bit about the preparation that went into this biography.
Well, there was a lot of travel. I commuted there for a while, and I lived in Silicon Valley for 14 months. Andy was not involved in this book in the following sense. It is not an authorized biography. He did not read a page of it until it came out in the form in which you see it right here. He was not involved in it financially. I sold it to a publisher myself. However, he was very cooperative. He gave me access to his notebooks, which he had kept from July of 1968, which is when Intel was founded, and which he never thought anybody would read. They were kept strictly for himself.
So these had never been seen before?
No, that's correct. And he also gave me access to his Rolodex, which meant that I was able to get literally dozens of interviews with people with whom it would have otherwise been difficult to get an interview. I also had a cubicle at Intel in Santa Clara for 14 months, and I also visited some of their sites, including their fabrication facilities, which are incredible manufacturing operations.
So you really immersed yourself in Silicon Valley for quite a while.
Very much so. It was. I ate it, I breathed it, I literally lived it for the period during which this book was being written.
Now, Andy lives in Silicon Valley, but he was born far away from Silicon Valley in Hungary in 1936. He came to this country about 50 years ago. And how did he get here? Where did he go? Give us a little bit of background on that.
Andy was born on the wrong side of history. He was born on September 2nd, 1936, in Budapest. He's of Jewish origin. Non-practicing, but nevertheless, to be a Jew in Hungary, whether practicing, whether observant or not, the Nazis didn't make those distinctions, and in fact, hundreds of thousands of Hungarian Jews died in Auschwitz. His father's mother, for example, as well as some of the relatives of his wife, Eva, who is a Viennese Jew. They lost a number of other relatives. They're not sure where, as is so often the case, whether it was on the Eastern Front or in a prisoner of war camp or what have you. So the first almost decade of his life, certainly during the Nazi period, he was literally a hunted child. His mother took him away from Budapest. They hid out in a cellar in a hovel in a suburb of Budapest called Kubanya, where his mother was raped by invading Russian soldiers. Then he returned, was lucky enough to return to his home on Kirai Street on the Pest side of Budapest, and he then had to endure a Soviet communist regime from 1945 when the Russians forced the Germans out of Budapest after a lengthy siege and very destructive siege until 1956 when the short-lived Hungarian revolt led to an open border between Austria and Hungary, and he made for the border.
So this was not an easy childhood, shall we say.
It was an extremely difficult childhood, although not an unhappy one. It was a close-knit family group. His father and mother loved one another, and they loved him, and he loved them. And he did very well in school and got a great deal of pleasure out of that. It really wasn't, I don't believe, until he finally got to the University of Budapest, which was shortly before he escaped, that he began to make Gentile friends, close Gentile friends. But no, it was extremely difficult. There were the need to find out what was actually happening in this man's life when he was a child was a life and death matter in the most literal sense. We're not talking about the life and death of an infirm. We're talking about the physical survival of a human being and of his parents and of their extended family. That was at risk for a large part of the first two decades of his life.
And you spend a lot of time in the book, quite rightly, talking about all this. Impact of these early years on his middle and later years?
The child is the father of the man, and Andy Grove is the last CEO who will ever have grown up under both Nazism, fascism, in other words, and communism. And somehow, in this strange brew, you take Nazism, add it to communism, divide by two, and wind up with one of the most important capitalists in American business history. So because of its very distinctiveness, it sets a lot of what it means to be a business person in sharp focus, and we're able to see it illustrated through his life. Hungary became, his experience in Hungary became a how not to do at university. I mean, if you could look at Intel and Intel culture under Andy Grove as the opposite of a great deal of what he experienced in Hungary, so I do spend some time. I went back to Budapest myself. He's never gone back to Hungary. I did go to Budapest. I went to his apartment and sent him an email from there because I felt it was important to do so.
Now, you just mentioned one of the most important capitalists of the century, I think you said. And in the book, you put him in the company of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. Why do you think Andy Grove is in that triumvirate? Why should he be in that triumvirate?
I believe that Steve Jobs, Andy Grove, and Bill Gates are the three people who put a computer on everybody's desk. I'm old enough to remember when IBM brought out the 360 in 1964.
This was a mainframe computer as big as this room.
Yeah. Oh, much bigger. and it was a mainframe world. And IBM was the company of companies in the industry of industries. It was Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, and Andy Grove who put that computing power in the hands of you and me.
Now, we'll segue a little bit into him as a manager. Now, he was a highly trained engineer, first in his class at City College of New York, PhD from Berkeley. But you say in the book that he was also a natural leader, that he was blessed with management skills, which he honed to a very fine point, as I understand it from your book. What were some of the management principles that made him such a success story?
Well, let me, if I may, go back to the beginning of your statement and then move on. It's noteworthy that he was educated at public universities. I mean, there was no tuition at CCNY, City College of New York.
And he was penniless when he came here.
He came here with nothing but the shirt on his back. I mean, he literally crawled out of Hungary. He left his parents on a street corner. There couldn't be a demonstration of affection because the Russians would think, gee, is this one making it for the border? You didn't know whether you were going to get across the border or not. There was no internet to give you border conditions that day. So by the time he gets here, which is as you point out, almost 50 years ago to the day. It was December 7th, 1956. He starts at City College almost immediately in January of 1957, and he had to go to a City College because they didn't have any money. Then he went to Berkeley, also a public institution, because they didn't have any money. So that's worth noting. And Andy, in his philanthropy, has been very focused on giving back. As far as his management principles are going, my understanding is that my recollection is that was the next part of your inquiry. Intel developed under Andy Grove a set of principles, a culture which is extremely strong and remains extremely strong to this day. But with him, certainly during the period in which he was CEO from 1987 to 1998, when its market capitalization increased 4,500% from about $4 billion to about $197 billion, the sense of, as they say at Intel, bleeding blue, of having a culture.
An Intel, sort of an Intel way.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, very much so. There was an Intel way. They had their own language. They have at Intel something called the TLA. TLA is a three-letter acronym for three-letter acronym. So if somebody says to you, that was BKM, you don't know what that means, do you?
Not at the moment.
It means best known method. And fortunately, there is a dictionary of TLAs at Intel. There are over 1,150 of them. So when you start doing research there, you need a sort of a
dictionary to get you through.
Yes. And it's like any strong culture, the Harvard Business School, for example, strong cultures have the defects of their virtues. But let's talk about their virtues first. As I say, Andy, in constructing Intel culture, I don't think he did this purposely or consciously, but it's turning Hungary on its head. For example, one of the tenets of Intel culture is knowledge power, not position power. It's what you know and what you can contribute, not what your title is or where you are in the organization that matters. Contrast that with what in the old days, you and I are old enough to remember Soviet communism, when Kremlinologists would take a look at who's standing on the Kremlin wall, where at the May Day parade.
There's a pecking order there.
Right, and that they would try to decode who has power by literally where they were standing.
Right.
That didn't matter to him. To him, it was a question of what you knew, not who you were. He believed that the heart of a corporation was its middle management, because he felt that there are Darwinian aspects to his beliefs, and if you are in top management, that's because you were very good at something 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago, maybe not today. Whereas middle management is really actually out there on the front lines. It's middle management, especially salespeople, who if a sale is lost, they feel it in their pocketbook or in their wallet right away. And if you listen to those people, you're not buffered by being at the home office. So if you've got bright middle management who are willing to, and this is another part of Intel culture, constructively confront you and your suppositions and your assumptions and the suppositions and the assumptions of the whole firm, you've got eyes and ears all over the country, all over the world, that give you a competitive edge. So these are all parts of Intel culture. Disagree and then commit. In other words, we'll listen to you, we'll fight, as he puts it in Only the Paranoid Survive, perhaps his best-known book, let chaos reign and then reign in chaos. In other words, get as many ideas as you can, but then once you do, come to a decision and create what Andy the engineer, calls a strategy vector. For him, it was the PC is it in the late 1980s, and that's what made Intel. Get everybody behind it. Among his other special talents was that because at Intel, another part of Intel culture, we argue specifically over principles or over proposals or over issues, not over the people who propose those. So we argue about issues, not about the people who propose those issues. And therefore, you're going to be heard, the issues are going to be heard, but if your side loses, you disagree and then commit. And once again, this is very different from Hungary, where you're stapled to the idea that you're holding on to, and during the Soviet era, for example, and if you're holding on to the wrong idea, it's worth your life.
So this is all the overhang from his youth that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. In my opinion, and this, I'm not trying to be amateur psychiatrist. I mean, you, if you just read about his early life, it slaps you in the face. I don't believe this point's been made elsewhere. But as his biographer, I'm telling you that something I believe.
And you mentioned one of his three management books, all highly regarded. The one you mentioned was Only the Paranoid Survive. And in that book, he has this concept of the strategic inflection point.
Yeah.
What is that all about?
Well, first, let me just say about, let me once again back up for a moment, if you permit me, and say a word about his writing. Andy's written dozens and dozens of articles for referee journals. He was tenurable as a chemical engineer at any major university anywhere in the world in his early 30s. He also wrote a textbook called Physics and Technology of Semiconductor Devices, which was widely adopted and widely praised. Andy has written six books. As a matter of fact, he's written an enormous amount. I don't think there's another CEO in American business history who has this kind of written output. It's unthinkable that he would have a ghostwriter, and there's only one of these six books that's co-authored, and that's the case book, which is Strategic Dynamics. High Output Management is a book that's gone through at least two editions. It's a book people still refer to, originally published in 83, republished in 95. Only the Paranoid Survive is his signature phrase, if you will. Is a book in which he does introduce the idea of strategic inflection point. And the basic idea of the strategic inflection point is companies come to a turning point. If you think of their arc, they're going like this, you know, and they can either then go off into the stratosphere
or head south.
It reminds me of the old Civil War hymn, "Once to every man and nation comes a moment to the side in the strife of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side." You've got to make the right decision at that moment, and if you do, you're going to go off to the strength. In other words, there do come key strategic inflection points, and they're very hard to decode. It's hard to do this right, especially in a tech world.
Let me go back to strategic inflection point, because he and his colleagues at Intel faced a number of situations where they literally, it seems to me, bet the company, changed its direction, so it kept going up. In the mid-80s, with the Japanese coming into the market with very cheap, shall we say, memory chips.
Well, they were inexpensive because the word cheap.
I don't want to imply quality, but it was inexpensive.
It was high quality,
right,
and inexpensive.
But inexpensive,
yes.
Very fine point.
Yeah.
There were other moments when, as you just said, they decided that the future of the company lay with the PC. There were alliances down the road with IBM and Microsoft. So could you elaborate a little bit on some of those?
Well, there were some key moments where they had to make key decisions. They had to get out of the memory business because they couldn't compete against the Japanese. With the 1103 memory chip displaced magnetic core memory in mainframe computers. And if you look at the first 10 years of their history as a public company, they did fantastically well. So the thought of no longer being the memory company was extremely difficult for them to take, and they were very emotionally caught up in this. And at one memorable moment, a key moment in the history of that company, Andy Grove is talking to his boss, Gordon Moore, and they're looking out the window at the Great American Amusement Park, which is, you can see from their cubicle on their cubicles on the fifth floor of the Robert Noyce Building in Santa Clara. And Andy looks at Gordon and says, if the board should kick us out and bring in new management, what do you think the new management would do? And Gordon answers immediately, get us out of memories. Mm-hmm. Andy then says, why don't we walk through the revolving doors, come in and do it ourselves? That's a very important moment. Why? Because Andy is able to use a device that gets him away from the legacy. I believe it was Stephen Dedalus. I could be wrong. I believe it was Stephen Dedalus in Ulysses. Who says history is a nightmare from which I'm trying to escape. The domestic automobile companies never had this device, and they're suffering from that reality right now as we speak. Legacy costs is all you hear from those folks. Andy was able to get to abstract himself from this and to look at it as if there were no legacy, and also the emotion that came with it. So if you take that out and you look at the reality, it's an easy decision. So he made that decision along with Gordon Moore, and they got out of the memory business. Now, another very important decision that was taken at the same time was to sole source the 386 up until 1986.
Now, explain what the 386 is.
The 386, Intel had a series of microprocessors. The microprocessor is the central processing. It is the most important piece of hardware in your computer. That's when you, if it says Intel inside, that's what's inside that matters. There was an 8086, there was an 8186, which had a very brief history. There was the 8286, and IBM, which was the king of the industry, always insisted that there be multiple sources. The excuse for this was that in case something went wrong with your fabrication facilities, we'd be able to source from somebody else. But the real truth behind it was they want a price competition. So with the 386, which was a device which Andy and Gordon and top management, and these people were all highly technologically astute and acute. These are smart people who know the insides of what these extremely complicated artifacts can do. Andy was convinced we have a device here that is very special. It took us a lot to develop, and he said we're going to sole source it, and that was a bet your company decision, because he was very worried that IBM wasn't going to adopt it because they didn't do this sort of thing. And if it didn't, they're your biggest customer. They're a million times your size. What's going to happen? And in fact, IBM didn't adopt it immediately, but by then clones were around, and Compaq adopted it first. That was the Compaq Desk Pro 386. And after Compaq adopted it, IBM had no choice. And that made Intel an independent company. As of that moment, IBM lost control of that industry. Mm. Then the industry was from then on driven by the Wintel, by the Microsoft Intel duopoly.
Now, you just mentioned that Andy has this ability to sort of pull back, and that helps him make these decisions. But he is human, and he has made some mistakes. And probably the most famous one involved, at least the most publicly known one, would have been the Pentium chip incident. What went wrong there?
What happened was that under certain circumstances, Pentium did not perform. There was a bug in the Pentium. There was a flaw. There was a floating point flaw in the Pentium chip.
This was a decimal point.
The floating point is a decimal point. That's correct. And under certain conditions, which are explained in the book in lay terms, and I'm not going to go into now, but in lay terms, they're simple to understand. The more complex you get, the more complicated it is. But
and when this happened, what did he do that wasn't...
Well, Andy allowed himself, in my opinion, at that time, to lose that magical ability to say, if new management were to come in, what would they do, or what have you. He believed too much in the product. He fell in love with the product and forgot about the customer. And something else very important, it happened to the company, which is that from 1990 on, the Intel Inside program had reached directly out to the consumer. So Andy, who grew up as an engineer, selling to, you know, six engineers at IBM, at Compaq, at Dell was hardly on the map then, but, you know, the companies that were making these clones, he didn't realize that that a brand is co-created. It's not just the company that creates, it's also the customer. And he was not able to look at the world through a customer's eyes. He kept saying, you know, this is a problem that's going to recur once every 27,000 times. It's a non-problem. We have specifications for when we have product recalls. This reaches none of them. That was all irrelevant. He was dealing in the world of perceptions. That's what mattered. And he was dealing in the world of the Internet. And this was one of the earliest times when something took off through the Internet, was out of control of everybody. Nobody knew how to look at it. And it was Andy was finally forced, against his will, to acknowledge that this is a problem, and they wound up having to take a very large write-off and promise to replace anybody's Pentium who wanted it replaced. He was, in other words, a lot of the story of Andy's success is point of view, and that was one where he was not able to get outside of himself and adopt a different point of view.
Interesting. Now, you've lived with him for a long time now with this book. Well, not terribly long, but long enough to write a fairly good-sized and insightful book.
461 pages of text.
To be exact.
Yeah.
What do you think his definition of leadership is?
Andy's very suspicious of the word leadership. The subtitle of the book is The Life and Times of an American, and Andy would not have liked it, I can absolutely guarantee you, if it had been called The Life and Times of an American Leader. The reason that he's suspicious of it is because if you took 1,000 MBA students, for example, and said to those 1,000 MBA students, would you rather be a leader or a manager? They'd all choose leader. Andy came up the hard way, you know, in an industry producing products that were so demanding that the slightest error would throw off a whole batch and cost a fortune. And as he once put it, in the early 1970s, he was living and dying on one or two points of memory. And Andy was the one who had to do the managing, and he has a great deal of respect for execution. As I said when I was listing his books, one of his books is High Output Management. There is no book High Output Leadership. He's more than a little suspicious of charisma. And his view of management and leadership basically is you're running a company, and most of that is management. But when leadership is called for, whatever that may be, there are a million different definitions of it. It's transformational as opposed to transactional, et cetera, et cetera. Then you play the role of leader if that's what the company needs of you. But he looks upon it very much, his own analogy is to a tennis player. A tennis player has a backhand and a forehand. You're a manager when you need to manage. You're a leader when you need to lead. You have to be a successful business executive at the top. You need both.
Well, this is a good way to segue perhaps into a situation where we're talking about charismatic or lack of charismatic, whatever you want to say, leadership. Hewlett-Packard, been in the news lately, serious problems there with the board and elsewhere. How do you think he might have handled a situation like that?
I think it depends on what point in time you're talking about. I don't believe that if Andy had been the chairman of HP 5-6 years ago, say, the situation would have developed. I don't believe the particular cast of characters that wound up turning the HP board into a train wreck would have been assembled. Now, Andy does have a special talent in getting people who don't like one another very much to work together, but that board was too far gone. I mean, the interpersonal conflict was just too great. I think he wouldn't have allowed it to develop.
He is now a senior advisor to Intel.
Yes.
But beyond that, what is he doing?
He's a man with a mission in healthcare. He believes that technology can do an enormous amount to cut healthcare costs. He believes there are technological solutions, not to every healthcare problem, but certainly to some of them that can cut costs. And as I say, he's a man with a mission in healthcare.
And his work on prostate cancer is
well known
from that Fortune magazine article.
Yes, indeed. He's also very concerned with Parkinson's disease, which he in fact does have. With the healthcare system in general. I mean, he believes that technology can't fix everything. It's not the answer to everything. There's no perfect solution to a system as complicated as this, but it can fix a lot, and a lot more can be done than is being done, and he's a crusader on that issue.
Well, amazing man, insightful book. We appreciate you being here.
Well, Jim, thank you very much. I appreciate your having me.